Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A new case of Alzheimer's disease is diagnosed every 70 seconds, a rate that is expected to quicken to 33 seconds by 2050 in the United States. Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death in the country. It affects 5 million Americans alone, and that's not counting their relatives. Author Gary Reiswig knows the drill of this disease all too well. He beat the 50-50 odds of early onset Alzheimer's in his family, but 10 out of the 14 members of the previous generation did not. Both his brother and sister died in their 50s with early onset Alzheimer's. He wrote a memoir about growing up with this disease. It's called The Thousand Mile Stair, One Family's Journey Through the Struggle and Science of Alzheimer's. And Gary, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Gary is in town. He is going to be appearing at Barnes & Noble Easton at 7 p.m. tonight, and he will be at the Newark County Library at 6 p.m. tomorrow night. Both of those events are sponsored by the Central Ohio Alzheimer's Association. And also joining us today is Michelle Shippis. She's Executive Director and CEO of the Central Ohio Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Michelle, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
And also, Ohio State University Clinical Neurology Associate Professor Dr. Douglas Shari. He conducts clinical research in dementia and mild cognitive dementia. Dr. Shari, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Gary, let's get started on the book. I read it last night, stayed up too late reading it, and I guess the idea that it affects so many people when you talk about those statistics is one thing, but when you talk about what your family went through, it's a whole nother thing. Can you tell us pretty much what makes your family's experience significant?
Well, our family's story really began in about 1936, in the middle of the Dust Bowl, where my family lived in the panhandle of Oklahoma. And my grandfather, grandmother, and one of my uncles started for town, and inexplicably, my grandfather drove in front of a once-a-day freight train at a wide-open crossing near Huntoon, Texas. You could see for miles in every direction, and nobody could explain what happened. And it wasn't until about 25 years later when my father and two or three of his siblings began to show the same kind of symptoms that the family had been aware of in my grandfather, some forgetfulness, at times some disorientation, a tendency to withdraw and be blank at periods of time, that generation, my mother and one of my aunts, my Aunt Esther, began taking their husbands, my father and my uncle, around to doctors. And finally, one doctor at the University of Oklahoma Medical Center said, "I believe these men have Alzheimer's disease." It was a name, it was a word nobody had heard of, but we now everybody knows the word Alzheimer's. So,
your family's share of the disease is unusual. There are more early onset cases in one family than any other in the U.S. that's known.
This is, to my knowledge, right. Our family, the extended family, the largest family that has the genetic familial form of early onset Alzheimer's. This is a very rare form of the disease. There are only 500 families, about 500 families worldwide, that are known to have a gene that causes the early onset form of the disease.
And the gene, the discovery of the gene is relatively recent.
That's true. Our gene was found in 1995, along with the gene on chromosome 14. And the earlier gene on chromosome 21 was found in 1991. So all of these genetic discoveries have occurred since 1985, when the NIH funded the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center throughout the country, and various research projects were conducted as a result of that legislation that started the ADRCs.
If you're just joining us, my guest, Gary Reiswig, he is the author of The Thousand Mile Stair, One Family's Journey Through the Struggle and Science of Alzheimer's. The Thousand Mile Stair is
is a great title for a book. I know exactly what you're talking about when you say that. How did it occur to you that that was sort of the rallying note?
Well, this was a phrase actually stated by my cousin Chuck, whose mother, one of my dad's sisters, had the disease. And he said that in their family, they came to refer these incidents of the faraway look as, oh, look, Mom has the thousand-mile stare again. And that was still at a point where nobody really understood the implications of this, but it really stuck in the family and became a kind of ringing note that this is a sign of something serious.
I have to, you know, from reading the book, your Aunt Esther was someone that is very easy to admire in the book. Way before her time, she was looking for help and trying to figure out what was going on. Back in a day and age when things like this happened, you sort of just shoved them under the carpet. You didn't want people to know, and you just try to be kind to them and, you know, keep them out of the public. But she was already talking back in the 70s about having places where people could go and live together safe in a safer environment.
Well, this is very true. She was a very visionary person, and you know, I'm very thankful for her. And
because she kind of got the family talking about it.
She did. She literally dragged and prayed the family into the research. without that effort, the family was hanging back, as you were saying earlier, not very willing to talk about this condition to anyone. I think it was a matter of fear and shame and not understanding that it was something that needed to be faced and dealt with from a scientific medical point of view.
A lot of the book is about your father, who was a remarkable person. Tell us a little bit about him, because the contrast from what he was to what he became in the end was stark.
Well, my father, my early memories of him are so vivid, and I admired him very greatly, and I just wanted to be like him. And he had he was a very highly awarded farmer in the Panhandle of Oklahoma. He did a number of firsts that he was awarded for, that he received awards for. And then when I was in my early teens, I started to notice something was happening. I didn't understand it, of course, at the time. But one of the things that happened was he became unable to repair his own machinery. And for a farmer of that era, that was just unthinkable. I mean,
he was a
mechanical genius. And when he became unable to put the combine back together, that was the first thing that we really noticed. He was so embarrassed. And two of my uncles came over and helped him finish the work. And he was so ashamed and so embarrassed about that. And then he started making poor business decisions. And this can happen to a person with Alzheimer's. And it could be maybe even an early sign if people start making bad decisions about money when before they have been very sound in their decision-making capacity.
We're talking about Alzheimer's. My guest, Gary Reiswig, author of The Thousand Mile Stare, One Family's Journey Through the Struggle and Science of Alzheimer's. You know, Gary, you didn't get the gene.
That's true. I did not inherit it. This is an autosomal dominant gene, and each child of an affected parent has a 50-50 chance of inheriting the gene. Now, in my father's generation of 14 children, this genetic coin toss accidentally resulted in 10 of the 14 siblings inheriting the gene from their father. In my generation, there are 25 people, 25 cousins in line to inherit the gene. And so far in my generation, 10 of the 25 have been identified as they've either already died because of the disease or they are living with Alzheimer's currently. And there are still, you know, maybe a couple of more that are within the possible age of onset. So, but
can't they be tested, though? Can't you rule it?
Well, now, this is a very interesting and problematic question, because since the gene has been found, you can get the test and find out if you have the gene in advance of having the symptoms. But so far in my family, only one person, my cousin Chuck, has decided to take the test before the symptoms of the disease appear.
And Chuck does have...
Chuck found out he did have it. He did have the gene, and he said it was very devastating to find this out. And yet he was glad he did find out, because that equipped him to start dealing with the disease when the symptoms did start to appear within a couple of years after the time he had the test.
You know, it's interesting, when you found out you don't have it, you were, I don't know if sad's the right word, or guilt or remorse or... Mm-hmm. How did that feel?
Yeah, well, initially I was very elated and happy. I remember feeling like I wanted to burst into song. I just wanted to sing. But it was at a time when my brother and his family had just been visiting, and he had already been diagnosed and was in the early stages of the disease. And I just, after that initial elation, felt tremendous sadness and even guilt over, you know, well, why me? Why did I wind up not having this gene when both my sister and brother did? And it wasn't until after I lived through that process of dealing with that feeling that I was able to take on this project and write the book.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to return to Gary Ryswick, author of The Thousand Mile Stair, One Family's Journey Through the Struggle and Science of Alzheimer's, and also Dr. Douglas Shari. He's an Ohio State University Clinical Neurology Associate Professor. He conducts clinical research in dementia and mild cognitive dementia and a whole bunch of other stuff. And also, Michelle Shippas, she is the CEO and executive director of the Ohio chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, or I should say the Central Ohio chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Give us a call if you have a question or comment about this topic, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do you know somebody who has Alzheimer's, and what has been your experience with it? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Your membership with WOSU provides for the great classical music and NPR news you rely on. By supporting WOSU, you support all your trusted local and national news and information, as well as the concerts, arts, and music you love. Is it time to renew your membership? Call 1-866-897-9678 or go online at wosu.org/give. And thank you for your continued support of WOSU.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News, and this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Good morning. Mostly sunny today with a high near 61. It's 50 degrees and fair currently. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of showers late and a low around 43. Tomorrow, some rain showers coming in the afternoon, high near 58. And Friday, a chance of freezing rain in the early morning with showers extending into the midday with a high around 45. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues now on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Alzheimer's today with Dr. Douglas Shari, Ohio State University Clinical Neurology Associate Professor, and also Gary Ryswick was just speaking about his new book, The Thousand Mile Stair, One Family's Journey Through the Struggle and Science of Alzheimer's. And also in the studio with us today, Michelle Shippas. She is Executive Director and CEO of the Central Ohio Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Dr. Shari, Alzheimer's is a form of dementia. What's the difference? How do you distinguish it?
Well, there's many causes of dementia, which really just means that people have trouble thinking. And so you could have a dementia from a head injury where you injure part of your brain and you never think well, or from too many strokes, thyroid disease, several different things. And Alzheimer's, though, is a type of dementia where you have these abnormal proteins that are overly produced by genes such as Gary's family there, that are not degraded away fast enough and overproduced in the brain, and these are toxic. These proteins build up, they misfold, they accumulate into these things called plaques, and there's also these tau proteins that make tangles, and they're toxic to nerve cells, kill the nerve cells, and you have this progressive forgetfulness and loss of judgment and those issues.
I said at the outset that a new case of Alzheimer's disease is diagnosed every 70 seconds, and that rate is expected to quicken to 33 seconds by 2050 in just 40 years. Why is that happening? Why is there this increase?
Well, I don't think that there's any epidemic or infectious cause or environmental cause really that's been identified. I think that it just relates to the fact that dementia is associated with older age groups. For Alzheimer's in particular, these proteins have to build up over a lifetime. So if you have a genetic defect that just increases the amount of these toxic proteins gradually over the years, they're not as toxic early on, but by the time you get to, in the general causes of the general ages of Alzheimer's, when you get to 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, they're increasing to the extent that they're bothering your brain and actually have killed nerve cells. And so since people are living longer, medical science has increased life expectancy tremendously, over the last 50 to 100 years. And so people are living longer, therefore there are more people that are getting this dementia. And also, of course, the baby boom population in the next generation is going to be hitting that age group. And so I think just from pure demographics and from people living longer is really the reason that we are going to see this tremendous increase.
Is Alzheimer's predictable in terms of genetics? So I could have a test for it and find out if I have a chance of it?
Well, just as Gary said, there are some genetic mutations that are known, okay, but they are very rare, and they usually occur in people that start very young, in their very young ages with this disease. And so if you happen to have one of these mutations, yes, we have a test that you can get, a blood test that will be 100% predictive of whether you have the gene. And if you do, then yes, if you live long enough, you will develop signs of Alzheimer's. Most people, though, with Alzheimer's, we don't know the genes. We do think there are some genetic predispositions. Some may just be idiopathic, or we don't know why. But a lot of cases, I think, run in families, even if you start at age 70s or 80s or even 90s. But we're looking for those genes. We haven't found them yet. A lot of research is going into finding genes that cause the most common type, the type that starts at an older age. And a lot of research is looking at that. But right now, for most people, getting genetic tests is mostly a waste of time and money because, we don't have the tools really to identify them.
Are more people coming forward to say they're concerned that they have Alzheimer's? I mean, Alzheimer's is so much more common now than it used to be. Every time somebody goes down to the basement to get a pair of socks and forgets what they went down there for, they make the crack. Oh, it's that Alzheimer's kicking in. But are people more worried about it these days?
I think that it's getting to be, more well-known, which is good, because a lot of times we struggle with people that don't come in soon enough, and we have treatments available that definitely slow down the decline and are very helpful for people, but they come in too late. And typically for most Alzheimer patients, they have less insight into this condition than their significant other, so that the people I'm most worried about are the ones that don't think they have problems, and the ones that really think that they may have problems most of the time don't. So that may be some comfort.
No, I've actually heard that. If you're wondering, if you remembered that you were supposed to go get the socks, you're okay. If you never figure it out. You developed the screening test that was intended to shorten the time between the first symptoms and access to treatment. What do you define as first symptoms?
Well, for Alzheimer's type dementia, almost always the first symptoms are forgetfulness, usually for short-term memory type things. I mean, they'll remember, you know, their wedding and emotional events and things that have happened in the past, but things that happened yesterday, you know, where what they had to eat for lunch, or of course I may have forgotten that too. But
I was going to say.
But things that are less important, don't have an emotional content, are things they're going to forget. Or a conversation, you know, we're going to be, we have to remember to pick up some milk at the store, and 5 minutes later they've forgotten that they had that conversation and don't write it down on their list, et cetera. So forgetfulness is clearly the, and memory is clearly a very early sign, but people also begin to lose a little bit of language. That is, they have maybe some trouble coming up with words, nouns that they used to be able to come up with quite quickly. Now, this can occur in anyone at certain times, but it just gets to be more prevalent and can be picked apart by some early testing, just testing thinking and memory. And the third thing might be directional abilities. Some people early on will lose their skills at you know, remembering where their car was parked, or going from a restaurant to get back to the table, which way do I turn? I mean, occasionally this happens, we get turned around, but it happens more and more with people with Alzheimer's disease, maybe get lost in familiar areas with driving, et cetera.
There's still no cure, but there are treatments. How do you measure the effectiveness of the treatments?
Well, that's fairly straightforward. We measure things such as their thinking and memory abilities. So we do some cognitive quizzes, and we measure how well they're functioning. So are they still able to do some cooking? Can they do the laundry? Do they have difficulties with the TV remote control? So over time, they lose some of these abilities. They can't figure out how to pay the bills, and they can't figure out how to cook, and someone else helps them with that, but they can still do the laundry and you know, lots of other tasks. And so we follow the changes over time with function, and we treat them. And if they're falling at a much slower rate, we call that a victory. Right now, we don't have cures. We have medications that work very well if started early. And they work much better if you start them early than if you just delay and think, ah, maybe it's nothing. I'll just hold on, or I'll wait. And that's the big problem with our medical model right now, is that people start way too late with these medications that are very helpful. It protects their brain. It prevents functional decline. It may delay needing more help. It would delay their loss of independence, all things that people really cherish that they can still do on their own. This will give them a few more years of extra functioning. Unfortunately, it doesn't cure or treat or change, and so eventually the disease overcomes that. But we are working on some great new stuff that hasn't come out yet, but we're working on some very interesting new research that we hope will be much better than the current treatments we have now.
What about lifestyle? I've read that older people who have stronger muscles or are in better shape have a reduced risk of developing, or at least can put it off a little bit longer. Is there anything to that?
I think that the brain has some plasticity, and so that if you use your brain, sort of the use it or lose it phenomenon, I think it does. That is true. And so we do encourage people, if you have a family history or you have early disease yourself, do things. Get out. Physical exercise also stimulates the brain, because you're looking and walking and running, or, you know, so all of the brain is involved in all of those types of things. Reading, puzzles, games, you know, anything, any sort of activity that's more active than passive can be very helpful. And so we definitely suggest remaining active, getting out, doing things, you know, as much as possible. And I think that does protect the brain a little bit and keeps the neurons happier.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. You're listening to Dr. Douglas Shari. He's Ohio State University Clinical Neurology Associate Professor. Also joining us today in the studio, Gary Reiswick. He's the author of The Thousand Mile Stare, One Family's Journey Through the Struggle and Science of Alzheimer's. And Michelle Shippas, of the Central Ohio chapter of the Alzheimer's Association is with us as well. Let's take a call. If you want to give us a call with a comment, 614-292-8513. And Dana, you're on the air. Hi, Dana. You want to talk about Lewy bodies disease?
Yes. I have a sister who died last year with Lewy bodies disease, which we were told was a form of dementia. I'm wondering if it's related, and I'm wondering about its onset. 5 years prior to that, a 32-year-old daughter of hers had suffered a severe stroke, which left her debilitated and disabled, and she was one of the sole caregivers through that 5 years, and then her health started deteriorating. Could that Lewy bodies have been brought on by this trauma to her family situation?
She was the one that had the Lewy body dementia?
Yes, the sister was at 70.
But not 70. Not the stroke victim, though.
No, not the stroke victim. That was her daughter.
Her daughter, I see. I don't think so. The stress, of course, causes lots of things, and I think it affects your immune system and can affect how you deal with things and mental and depression issues and things like that. But dementia with Lewy bodies is associated with another abnormal protein, not the amyloid or tau we see in Alzheimer's, but a completely different one called alpha-synuclein. And it builds up and bothers other nerve cells in different parts of the brain that are not the exact places that we see with Alzheimer's. Some places they have some overlap, but particularly they affect areas, deep parts of the brain that affect movements a lot, slowness and abilities to manipulate objects. Tremors sometimes occur. Hallucinations are frequent. So it seems to be a completely different disease, and I don't think that stress would increase the rate of deposition of these abnormal proteins. I think that probably, probably didn't help things in general if you're more stressed with anything, any disease you have, but I don't think it was probably related.
All right, thank you. One quick question in addition. A year prior to that, she had been diagnosed with Parkinson's. Are these directly related?
For Lewy body disease, many times before you get the dementia or the cognitive or memory problems, you get Parkinson-type symptoms. And so if it's within the first 2 years they have Parkinson's disease and then start dementing, we just call that Lewy body disease. And really it's Lewy body disease the whole time, but at the beginning we can't say because they're not demented then, and so we call it Parkinson-type disease. And if they start dementing, we say, okay, this is really just the beginnings of Lewy body dementia. So I would say that she probably just had the Lewy body dementia. That would be her, diagnosis for the whole time, beginning with the Parkinson-like symptoms the first year.
I see. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dana, for your call.
All right. Uh-huh.
Gary, a short temper was part of what you had to live with your father, became angry easily. What was that like? And because he wasn't like that at all before.
Well, this is part of a personality change that can happen with people who are developing Alzheimer's disease. It can take that form or many other forms. When the doctor was speaking, I was thinking that one of the early symptoms that I had noticed in my family through a couple of generations is people forget what they've just said. He was talking about short-term memory. And this is a worrisome sign. If you're in a conversation with several people and one of the participants starts to tell the same story over and over again three or four times within the course of a 10 or 15-minute conversation, that's a little bit of a cause for concern that they're not remembering, well, I just told that story 5 minutes ago.
Dr. Sherry, what is the cause of that personality change? Why does it manifest itself that way?
Well, the brain is a wonderful organ, and it controls basically everything we think and how we act. And so all our nerve cells that control our interaction to environment, our reactions to our environment, and particularly our emotions can be affected. And so if those nerve cells that are responsible for emotions and reaction to environment start dying away, then we have issues with reality sometimes, thinking that things are true when they're not, mixing up memories, but being very sure that someone stole something and not being able to convince them otherwise, for example. This could lead to irritability and arguments between family members. They can get quite restless or pacing, want to find or go home, even though they are home. Their mood changes. They can get irritable or depressed. These are all changes in the brain due to those abnormal proteins that are building up and just happen to be hitting those particular nerve cells that are responsible for our mood and behaviors.
Gary, and the book, I can't remember, and I apologize, whether it was your father or your uncle, but I think it was Aunt Esther who at first went to live in the city, or it was your aunt, another aunt, that went to live in town with her husband who had Alzheimer's, one of your uncles, and it didn't go well, so she ended up bringing him back out to the farm, and they built a separate house. I apologize, I can't remember her name.
Okay, well, this was my my father and mother, actually. When my father was no longer able to do the work on the farm, mother turned the farm over to my sister and brother-in-law, who, you know, were experienced because they had grown up on the farms. And my parents moved to town. But at that point, Dad felt so dislocated. Everything that was familiar to him was no longer in front of him. And mother finally had a separate house built out on the farm, and they moved back out. And that really helped my dad for a couple of years, because he was able to do things alongside my brother-in-law, things that he had formerly done in some capacity or another. And he was able to really sustain himself on a better level than he would have been if he had stayed in town in what was a totally strange environment with nothing for him to really do and to contribute to the family.
Is that pretty typical, Dr. Sherry?
Yes. So the old memories are stored many places in the brain, and so you have to destroy much more of the brain to lose all those good old memories. So the familiar places, the farm, the tractor, the combine, or whatever it might be, and those are comforting. Home is comfort for all of us, and familiar things are comfort. And if you're constantly in a strange environment because you can't remember yesterday or last week or last month, everything's always new, and that's stress-inducing. So while those cells are still living with old memories, I think that's very typical.
Okay, we have to take a short break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
The creators of the satirical animated series South Park are used to being at the center of controversy, but they don't always see it coming.
There has been a lot of times where we've opened up the paper, pulled up the Drudge Report or something, and it's like, South Park does this, and you're like, oh, God, what do we do? And you find out from the paper.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creators of South Park, Matt Stone and Trey Parker. Join us.
Fresh Air is coming up today at noon, just about 20 minutes here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich this week. 50 and fair right now, mostly sunny with a high near 61 today. Mostly cloudy tonight with a slight chance of showers, late low around 43. Tomorrow, showers in the afternoon, high near 58. And Friday, chance of freezing rain in the early morning with showers extending into the midday, high around 45. When you don't have time to catch the whole story, get the update with the WOSU Daily News Loop. Receive award-winning local coverage and NPR headlines emailed every weekday right to your inbox. Catch up with current events or listen to a story you missed with the WOSU Daily News Loop. To sign up, go to wosu.org/email.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Gary Ricewig. He is the author of The Thousand Mile Stare, One Family's Journey Through the Struggle and Science of Alzheimer's, and that happened to be his family. Also, Dr. Douglas Shari, he's Ohio State University Clinical Neurology Associate Professor. And also, we haven't heard from her yet, but Michelle Shippas is in the studio. She is the Executive Director and CEO of the Central Ohio Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Michelle, what does an organization like that do for people?
Well, you know, we're really there to help the families and even the individuals with Alzheimer's really from diagnosis to the end, really help them with all kind of resources, education and understanding and support. We provide 30-some support groups throughout our 14-county service area, but there are chapters throughout the country. So there's support groups, there's education. We help them provide just basic information about, you know, what this disease is, better understanding in education for the caregivers and how to provide care. So there's quality of life if you want to keep that person at home. In fact, 70% of individuals with Alzheimer's are cared for at home, and that care is unpaid for. We also have a helpline so that anytime anyone has any type of information, we really try to provide information on just care planning so that from the beginning, and I think, you know, Gary mentioned this, you know, his cousin wanted, you know, once he found out he had the disease, he could plan, you know, what are those decisions, you know, power of attorney, all those types of things that you want to think about. So as the disease progresses, the family's ready. Everybody's ready to understand the decisions that have to be made, or those decisions are made ahead of time. So as the disease progresses, everybody is understanding. And then along the way, just as the disease progresses, anything that we can help out, understand, connection to community resources, those are the things that we provide. Sometimes there's nurses or occupational therapists on staff, safety evaluations, medication evaluations.
Someone can go into your home and check out your house to see if it's...
Absolutely, okay. Yeah. Wandering's a key issue. I know they were talking earlier about wanting to go home, and sometimes they look in the mirror and they see themselves as they were 20, 30, 40 years ago, and they want to go to their childhood home. So wandering's a huge issue, so we really want to help them, caregivers, how do they keep them at home? How do they keep them safe? And so any type of devices, any thing that will help if they, in the event that they do wander, identification. So we have a medic alert, safe return program, a comfort zone. So just really throughout the continuum of the disease, helping them with tools, resources, support, just an ear sometimes we're there.
I would imagine, Gary, that something like that, that's what Ann Esther wanted so much, was to just get organized.
That is true. And our family now, from the later generations, have had many great experiences with the Alzheimer's Association, and the family is no longer sort of centered in the panhandle of Oklahoma and Texas, but are really scattered throughout the country. And the Alzheimer's Association is a great organization. And it's amazing that I can say this from all the experiences we've had in the different sections of the country. But the services and help that our family has gotten from the Alzheimer's Association has always been positive.
Dr. Shari, is there a relationship between an organization like the Alzheimer's Association and your ability to kind of cope with the disease as a researcher and help treat people? Is there a health component there to having a group like that out there?
Oh, it's tremendous. And the Central Ohio Chapter has been a fantastic resource for all Central Ohioans. And they're really a fantastic group of people that I've got to know there, and well worth if you have family members or you yourself are having the disease, to contact them, because it's a wealth of information. For busy practitioners obviously don't have these resources, they can diagnose the patient with Alzheimer's, but all the other family and legal and social and safety issues can be helped tremendously by this fantastic organization, which provides free advice and support, and it it's very helpful for the practitioner to know that there's a group there that can help answer the questions. Otherwise, a lot of questions get back to the physician. They may or may not have the right answers or resources to deal with some of these legal or financial questions. And that's where these Alzheimer's Association groups across the country are so very important. And I recommend all physicians to have their local chapter number to hand off to the patient and family as soon as they're diagnosed so that they can take advantage of the great information to be prepared for things that lie ahead for them.
614-292-8513. Dr. Sherry, I think we have a couple questions for you. Nathan, thanks for holding on. You want to talk about the pre-screening?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Sherry, of course, this question is directed to you. Now, I came in the middle of the conversation. I do apologize if you already described this. But I was wondering, for the pre-screening, would it help if people who are at risk, if every 10 years or so they are screened or more frequently, depending on the risk factors, that way a sort of mental biography can be created and generated so they have a better understanding of the thought process of the individual? Would that help the pre-screening process to detect the early signs of the onset of Alzheimer's?
Yes, I mean, I think that that would be very useful. If you know that it runs in the family, then you're already sort of pre-warned, and so those people are a little bit more acutely attuned to particular changes. Usually, though, to keep in mind that if your parent had developed Alzheimer's in 75, for example, then typically if it runs in family, subsequent generations are going to hit about the same generation, about the same decade, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So usually a parent gets it at 75, you're not going to get it at 55. And if they get it at 85, that probably means you won't get it till 85 if you're so unlucky to get it. So, but it is great to have a sort of baseline memory or thinking evaluation done. And there are some very simple ones that don't cost lots of money. We are certainly working on very techno-savvy instruments. We have now PET scans. We can inject particular dyes, and it will identify these abnormal proteins, the amyloid in particular. We have spinal fluid taps that can measure tau and amyloid. These are these abnormal proteins in the spinal fluid. But these are all, you know, relatively expensive type tests, and until we get a medication that can actually modify the disease or get rid of these proteins, it's probably not something that, you know, is ready for just routine use. But what is very useful, I think, is to get some baseline cognitive tests, and there are tests that you get in your doctor's office that doesn't take the doctor much time. We have just devised a short screening test called SAGE that can be done in a doctor's office. Self-administered test that can give a good baseline. And then you could repeat it again if you get to maybe over 60 or something, get it every couple years and see if there's any changes. I think that would be a great idea.
Okay, Nathan?
Yeah, that's fine. That was a great answer. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Vivian, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
I have a question for Dr. Sherry. Dr. Sherry, if in a screening with an MRI of the brain, doctors find age-related, I believe it's called age-related, fatty tissue, they just see rather normal white fatty parts of the brain, could that be possibly abnormal protein, and could these age-related fatty deposits in the brain eventually cause Alzheimer's or dementia? Could that could these fatty portions of the brain also have been caused by a poor lifestyle?
Okay, Dr. Sherry.
Well, most of what you see, I'm not sure. I think what you're describing are white matter signal abnormalities, which are usually due to small blood vessels clogging up a little bit. It would be rare to have actual fat deposits, although the brain is actually mostly lipid or fat, because that's all the nerve cells are covered with that, but it's too small to see on a routine MRI scan. So you're probably talking about some small vessel disease, which is very common as people get older. If you have a lot of it, it can be related. You can get vascular dementia. That is, if you destroy enough of your brain because of your blood vessels are clogged up, that can cause a dementia, but it's not Alzheimer's disease. And so those abnormal proteins I was talking about in Alzheimer's cannot be seen on a routine MRI scan. You would see maybe some shrinkage of the brain as the brain cells die, but you wouldn't be able to see these particles. On specialized scans, as I said, that are still mostly research called amyloid PET scans, then you can see these amyloid peptides because we have a dye that actually attaches to the amyloid and we can see it there. Those still are not yet out for routine examination. They're still just in research.
Okay. Vivian, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We have an email from Linda. She writes that my father had Alzheimer's disease and he was very anxious. When he was prescribed medication for anxiety, his personality greatly improved. He was able to connect with people emotionally. Are there medications that can help patients deal with anxiety, anger, and other symptoms once they have Alzheimer's?
Yes, very much so. As some nerve cells die in the brain, that nerve cell may be responsible for different chemicals, particularly for anxiety. We talk about serotonin and norepinephrine. And so you have a deficit in the brain. You don't have enough of that material, and so we can give it by pill form. These are called antidepressants usually, help tremendously with anxiety, irritability, and it tries to help adjust some of the losses that we see in the brain due to these abnormal proteins that kill the brain cells. So we can do quite a bit, physicians can do quite a bit in treating abnormal behaviors and making people's lives more comfortable and also, of course, caregivers' lives tremendously easier to deal with the loved ones.
Speaking of caregivers, Michelle Shippas from the Central Ohio chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, what do you do in terms of helping caregivers? Are there respite programs and that sort of thing? Because a lot of people do stay in the home now.
Yeah, they do. And there are a lot of programs out there. The Central Ohio Area Agency on Aging has some wonderful resources that are available. And again, what we try to do is connect them to those resources so that they might be able to have a homemaker come in. Sometimes there's financial support for adult daycare or if they have private pay opportunities. You know, we really strongly suggest that they do put their loved one in an adult day program for a couple days a week so that they can get out. You know, the biggest thing is that just like, you know, the child in the airplane, you know, when you know, the stewardess is kind of going over all the emergency, you know, as a parent, you need to take care of yourself before you take care of that child. And just the caregiver needs to do the same thing because it can be emotionally draining, physically draining. And what we don't want to happen is for that caregiver to get sick or disabled or even die before that person with Alzheimer's does. And so we really try to emphasize for that caregiver to take care of themselves and find resources for respite and some other things that they can do to take care of their health.
Yeah, Gary, the folks in your stories and in your family, pretty amazing people, the way they were so resilient when there was so little known about it and there was really no help out there.
Yes, this was, of course, before the Alzheimer's Association, my father's generation. Mm-hmm. And everybody was just having to try to make do with what they had. In my father's case, we felt sort of fortunate because the disease affected a portion of his brain that appeared to shut down his liver, and he actually died officially of liver disease. You know, it was not maybe the easiest way to go, but because it did last for a few weeks. But he didn't linger on past the time when he was able to take care of his own bathroom functions and that sort of thing. But then there were other cases where, of his younger siblings that then some of that generation also had to be put into the nursing home to be cared for because a family's resources are limited and you know, you don't want to start getting violent or, as Michelle said, start affecting the health of the caregiver.
Let's take a call, 614-292-8513. We just have a few minutes left. But, Jane, you did want to know about how Alzheimer's actually brings about death.
Yes.
Well, typically, patients lose their language ability, and they can't communicate well, and they may feel bad. Maybe they have an infection they can't tell anyone about, a little pneumonia, and they maybe don't generate a fever or something. And so by the time people realize they haven't been eating, maybe there's an infection, it sort of overwhelms the whole system. So they may die that way through infection. That's a very common cause because of their lack of communication. They're not getting proper treatment early enough, or no one's picking up on it. And the other way is they lose the ability to figure out not only how to cook, but then to cut their meat, and they have to be fed, and then even to swallow. So then if you can't swallow food or drink, then it just sort of sticks in your mouth. You can't figure out how to move your mouth or tongue so that you swallow correctly, and you lose more and more weight until you pass away that way.
Does that help, Jane?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Gary, there was a case in your family of they weren't really sure where the disease was going to go and what was happening, and they had started using a feeding tube. And by the time, tell us a little bit about that. We have about a minute.
Yeah, well, this relates to what the doctor was just saying. In our family, we've decided to, you know, try to avoid this, to get in our family discussions, avoid using artificial means of support. And my aunt, who allowed the Veterans Hospital to use the feeding tube with my uncle, and it just necessarily prolonged his life, in his case, for years after he would have passed under normal conditions. And he was totally unconscious, totally without mental response.
And she wanted to remove the tube, but by then it was too late. It would have been a big legal battle and that sort of thing.
Well, that was true, and you know that was a good decade and a half or two ago. So I'm not sure what the regulations about that would be now.
Okay, Michelle, do you give people advice on that sort of a thing? We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, what we do is again provide them with literature and information and empower them to make the best decision. And also, palliative care doctors are a great resource as well. So that's the kind of information. Our website, alz.org, has a great wealth of information. Our helpline is 800-272-3900. That's available 24 hours a day.
Okay, we'll get those things posted on wosu.org/allsides. I want to remind folks that the author, Gary Reiswaite, will be at Barnes & Noble Easton tonight at 7 p.m. and at the Newark County Library at 6 p.m. tomorrow night. Gary Reiswaite, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Gary's book, The Thousand Mile Stare, One Family's Journey Through the Struggle and Science of Alzheimer's. Also, Dr. Douglas Shari, Ohio State University Clinical Neurology Associate Professor. Dr. Shari, thanks for being with us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And Michelle Shippis, she is CEO and Executive Director of the Central Ohio Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Thanks again, Michelle, for joining us today.
Thanks, Ann.
And that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.